Just gonna let Chuck in. So the series for the year, as always, is dedicated by Ruthie and Michael Mammon, and this session in particular, with donations from the Day of Giving by Karen and Jay Spitzer and Mindy and Fred Tayar. So we are up to Perek Yud Zayin, chapter 17, and it was already noted in the discussion a minute ago that we're getting towards the end, and that is certainly true. But more than that, we're getting to the last part of the Sefer. And what I mean by that is that you can actually split Sefer Shoftim in three parts. The first part of Shoftim is professionally known as the boring part. That was the first two chapters, basically, in which you get the introduction to the Shoftim spiral, in which you learn about the cycle in which the Jews don't do what God tells them to do, they get zapped, they get a shofet who leads them out of it. At some point in that cycle, they might do tshuva, they might not do tshuva, and it's basically two chapters of, be aware that this is a book about bad people. That's more or less your introduction to Shoftim. Then you get chapters 3 through 16, which we've now completed, and those are stories involving individual Shoftim leading the Jews, going all the way back to Asniel ben Knaz and Ehud ben Gera, and some of those passages hopefully are familiar. Then you hit Devorah, chapter 4, chapter 5. You had Gidon, chapters 6 through 8. You had that weird business with Avimelech. You had the mini Shoftim, Tola, Yair, Avdon, right? This should sound somewhat familiar to those who have been here for a while. Then you hit Yiftach, and following Yiftach, you had Shimshon. But those were stories that were fundamentally Shofate-centric. The events that took place were really the Shofate's adventures as hopefully leader of the Jews, although in some of those stories it wasn't so clear-cut that they were leading anything. The last chapters of the book, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, are the third part of Sefer Shoftim, and they are very different. And the first thing you notice as you read the story, or maybe not the first thing, but certainly a key thing to notice, is that there are no Shoftim. And the text is actually going to say that multiple times. Ein melech b'Yisrael. There is no king in Israel. Not only is there no king, there's no shofet. And when there is no shofet, as the text says, Ish hayashar be'inav ya'aseh, everyone does what they think is right. And you notice the phrase, hayashar be'inav ya'aseh. Each one does what is right in his eyes. And of course, given what we've been learning for the last few months, you think, oh, wait, what's right in his eyes, you think of Shimshon, right? Who makes all his best decisions based on what is right in his eyes. So that's what you're going to see for the rest of the book. But that leads to a very interesting question. First of all, take a look at the sheet, at source number 1, please. I want to just give you some orientation here to the story we're about to see before I talk about this last section. I should have mentioned it before. This is the story known as Pesel Micha, the statue of a man by the name of Micha. And the way the story plays out, in a nutshell, is that there's a fight between a mother and her son about some missing money. The money is ultimately found, and it's used for a purpose which is either idolatrous or quasi-idolatrous. It's not quite clear, but they set up something involving worship. And apparently they set up their little idol shtiebel in the backyard, because COVID. And the way that it works is that, this fellow is Micha, is running the show, the son from the fight between the mother and the son, until a Levi stops by. And this wandering Levi is looking for work, looking for support, really. And Micha is jumping up and down with excitement. Hey, we got a Levi. That's great. He can be a priest in my house of whatever it is that he's doing there. We're going to talk about whether it's idolatrous or not. So this upwardly mobile Levi has now made himself a Kohen. and he's working in this house of idolatry of some kind. And then following that, the tribe of Dun has a mission come through the area on their way north. They're looking to expand their territory. We'll have to talk about that too. But on their way north, they stop off in the house, they meet this Levi, and have a little conversation with him, and then on their way back, they say, "Hi, Levi, you know what? We'd like you to come be with us. We'll give you an upgrade. Instead of you just hanging out here in this house, you could be the priest for an entire tribe." And they don't really give him this kind of offer you can't refuse type offer. And so he ends up going along with them. And that's the story. That's the story of the idol of Micha. The whole thing is so strange. And it's played for laughs. The story is played for humor. And you'll see that very clearly, in particular, in the actions of the Levi. Even though it's a sad story, like stuff's going on here that shouldn't be happening. Nonetheless, it's played very ironically. And it's played very humorously. As opposed to chapters 19, 20, 21. There is nothing funny going on in that story. That's the story of Pelegish Begiva, the concubine at Giva, which starts out with a man and his concubine and a falling out between them, goes from that into a horrific rape and murder, and then from that, a civil war in which thousands of Jews are killed by thousands of other Jews. The tribe of Binyamin is nearly eliminated. The solution to the problem of eliminating the tribe of Binyamin is let's have the remaining males of Binyamin kidnap women so that they can procreate and produce like a new tribe of Binyamin. Like, it is absolutely, in the eyes of most people who learn this story, the absolute worst story in Tanakh. And, you know, we have some doozies, but, like, this one really takes the cake. You just look at that and say, are these the people I'm supposed to recognize and consider my ancestors? It's a big, big problem, that story. So, these two stories, from chapter 17 through the end of the book, don't seem to fit with the rest of the book. As I mentioned, there's no Shofate. But we'll see, there's more about these stories that really marks them as separate. So, commentators historically have argued that these stories did not take place where they are in the book. That these stories did not take place after the time of Shimshon. Rather, these stories go all the way back to the beginning of the period of the Shoftim, before the first Shofate. Between Yehoshua and Othniel ben Kenaz. And it's dislocated to be here. That is the view of the Medrash, Seder Olam, which tries to provide a chronology of events in Tanakh and beyond. That is the view as well of Rashi. That is the view of Ralbag. That is the view of critical scholars as well. They, take a look on your sheet, please, at source number 2, and you'll see Ralbag. He says, "V'hinei achshov, I think, shekvar hayazeb beyamim hakidumim." This happened back in the early period. Shaloaya sham shofet. There was no shofet. V'hayazeb bimei hashibud. It was during the period of subjugation to some non-Jewish enemy, whoever it was, Midian, Moab, Ammon, Amalek, whatever you want. Im kodem Othniel ben Kenaz, maybe it was before Othniel, the first Shofate. Im kodem Ehud, maybe it was before Ehud, who's after Othniel. Right, you remember Ehud, he was the lefty, the one who stabbed Eglon, king of Moab. Im kodem Achad me'abayim achrayim, or before one of those who followed them. But it's early in the period of the Shoftim, at a time when there is no Shofate. That's Ralbag's contention here. Mind you, Abarbanel is absolutely unable to accept this idea, for reasons we'll get back to. He is going to insist not. Radak is going to defend the idea that it occurs at the end of the book as well. But the majority view is that this story doesn't happen at the end. So the first question that I want to look at is the question of why believe that these stories are displaced? Besides my point that there's no Shofate, and that in of itself is a flag, but why believe that these stories are happening at the beginning of the book and not at the end of the book? So a lot of this depends on evidence that you don't have yet. You haven't read the stories yet, and it's from the stories themselves. But I'll give you a couple of pieces of evidence to work with.
If you can you say that each story in the Shoftim can be anywhere in the chronology of the Shoftim?
Well, some of them feed directly off of the preceding stories. Avimelech feeds right off of the story that precedes him, in a very clean way, and into the story that follows him. Like, some of the Shoftim are very clearly sequential, but also the commentators tend to assume they're sequential. So Ralbag and Abarbanel in particular spend a lot of energy trying to calculate how long each Shofet was a Shofet. And questions like, when the text says that it was quiet in the land for 40 years, does that include the period from the beginning of the Shofet, including the time they were suffering under X enemy, or is that only the quiet time at the end? Like, they work on that, working with the assumption that it is meant to be read chronologically. They, even though, theoretically, yes, some of them probably could, and without violating the integrity of the text. As a matter of fact, we discussed that a little bit. You may recall, I think you were already on board, when we were talking about the mini Shoftim, the five records of short periods of Shoftim that were grouped together, right? You had two of them together and you had three of them together. And we had the question of why are they grouped together? And there was some suggestion that maybe they were gathered to that spot and didn't occur at that moment in time. So there are such arguments. But take a look at chapter 18, sentence 31. This is the end of the story of the idol of Micha. After this whole saga plays out, and what a weird story it is, it says, "Vayasimu lahem es pesel Micha asher asa." They set up this statue of Micha that Micha had made. "Kol yemei heyos beis ha'elokim b'shilo," for as long as the house of God was in Shiloh, the Mishkan was in Shiloh. So that's a really interesting statement to make. The Mishkan was in Shiloh from, like, ages ago. Mishkan stood in Shiloh for, I think, 369 years, the Gemara in Zvachim says, until the time of Shmuel. It's destroyed in the time of Eli and Shmuel. So take a look at Rashi in source number 3, commenting on this point. Rashi says, "Ava pishenichtav shtei parshios halalu b'sof ha-sefer." Even though these two portions, meaning the idol of Micha and the concubine story, even though they're recorded at the end of the book, Shal Micha v'shal Pilegesh begiva b'tchilas ha-shoftim haya, they actually happened in the beginning of the period. B'mei Osniel ben Kenaz, he says it's during the first Shofet, Osniel. Shenemar, as the Pasuk says, "V'yasimu lahem es pesel Micha ... kol yemei heyos beis Elokim b'shilo." They placed the statue of Micha as long as the house of God was in Shiloh. So he says, "Lamadnu shekol yemei Shiloh haya demus shal Micha." So that must mean that it was around as long as the Mishkan was in Shiloh. So that must mean it happened way, way back in the very beginning. Rashi says that. Malbim brings that argument as well. Of course, there's an easy answer. What's the answer to this idea? What's the answer to this point? How else could you read chapter 18, sentence 31? Yeah.
Well, you could say that it was on from that time until...
Correct. Chuck, that was what you're going to say also? Yeah. You could say this idol, her statue, was in Shiloh, was there as long as the Mishkan remained in Shiloh from this point forward until the destruction of the Mishkan in Shiloh. And Radak and Abarbanel agree with Gerald and with Chuck that that's a simple solution. But there's more to it. Jumping into the story of the concubine at Giva. In the beginning of that story, the concubine and the man who was with her, I struggle, and I'm going to continue to struggle with what to call him. He's not her husband. I don't know a word for man who has concubine that's, you know, appropriate. So but if you look at chapter 19, sentence 12, they're traveling. And there's a fear of, it's getting dark, we need a place to stay, where can we stay? And the man says, Lo nasur el ir nochri. I don't want to go to a foreign city, asher lo mibnei Yisrael, which is not a Jewish city. Now, what city is he talking about? If you look at sentence 11, it says that the city they're talking about, I'm sorry, sentence 10, the city they're talking about is none other than Yerushalayim. But they say that the city is held by the Yevusi, by the people of Yevus. In the beginning of the book of Shoftim, we read that the tribe of Yehuda conquered Yerushalayim. So it wouldn't have been a Yevusi city at that stage. Elamai, then what? So Rashi says to you, the answer is that in fact, this story is taking place before Yehuda conquers Yerushalayim. Now, Yerushalayim will go back to being Yevusi later on. We know that by the time of David, the Yevusi controlled the city. Nonetheless, this is a point made by Rashi to argue, again, that this story must take place in the beginning of the book of Shoftim, and that's why the city is Yevus-controlled. Ralbag always has his eye on the clock. I mentioned it before. Ralbag is the one who always wants to know how many years did this take place and how does it fit into the calendar of events that run from when we leave Egypt until we build a Beis HaMikdash. And Ralbag makes the argument, simply put, that you don't have enough time after Shimshon for these stories to take place. He says, given the number of years that we know elapse from the time of Yehoshua until the time that Shlomo builds the Beis HaMikdash, and we know how many years it is, because Tanakh in the book of Malachim tells us how many years it is. Sorry? Yes, 480 years. So he says, it can't be. There isn't enough time after Shimshon and before you go to Eli and Shmuel for you to have this massive civil war that's going to go on, the story of Pelegesh Begiva. He says it simply doesn't work. Abar Benel is not impressed. He says, come on, we've made harder calendars work. He doesn't think that that's such an issue. And frankly, this issue comes up elsewhere as well with the career of Shmuel and the career of Shaul. If we proceed from Shoftim into Shmuel, we'll get to have a lot of conversation about that. Professor Elitzur, in the Dot Mikra edition, adds a few other reasons to say these stories happened early. I mentioned that in the story of Pesalmicha, the tribe of Dun is going to conquer an area up north. They're going to say, our land isn't good enough for us, it doesn't have enough space for us, we need to go conquer additional land. So Professor Elitzur, and Malbim says this as well, Malbim at the end of Shoftim says that the period of conquest is in the beginning. One of the problems that we get blamed for in Shoftim is that we weren't conquering. So he says, conquest sounds like it would have happened early on. You could argue that point. But then he makes two other points regarding figures who show up in these stories. And this is fascinating. I'm going to blow one of the great secrets of Pesalmicha, which I'm reluctant to do because it's one of these really fun things when you do it when you get to the end of the story. So I'm going to spoil it for you. So if anyone really doesn't want a spoiler, if you want to tune out and come back in a couple of minutes, that's fine. But for those who are okay with a spoiler, or have learned the story before anyway, take a look, please, at chapter 18, sentence 30. At the very end of the story, we get the name of this Levi, this mysterious, upwardly mobile Levi. Someone read that name to me, please.
Gershon ben Menashe.
Close. Sorry?
Yonatan
ben Gershom ben? Did it say Menashe in your text?
No. Moshe.
Yeah, is that Menashe or is that Moshe? So when we get to the end of the story, we're going to read more about this and why there's a nun suspended above the line, something that is pretty rare in Tanakh. and we'll talk about where it does appear and what the common denominator is between the stories. But Yonasan ben Gershom ben Moshe, there is only one person that can be, as the Gemara is going to explain, and that is Moshe's grandson. Grandson of Moshe Rabbeinu is the Levi in this story. Now, the point for us, which Professor Eli Tzur makes, is the period of the Shoftim is a long period of time. As Chuck noted, it's 480 years from the time you get out of Egypt until the time they build the Beis HaMikdash. Subtract from that 40 years in the wilderness, and you're at 440. Actually, you don't need to, because this one would have been around. He would have been around from somewhere in that period of time, but let's do that anyway. Subtract the 40 years. You're at 440. Subtract the 40 years that David is king, and you're down to 400. 400 years from the beginning of the period of the Shoftim until you get to whatever is happening in the time of Shaul, whose reign is only for a couple of years, unless I adopt a different chronology there. That's its own discussion. But the mainstream is Shaul only king for a couple of years. How in the world is Moshe's grandson still alive and kicking at this point in the story, says Professor Eli Tzur. That's hard to accept. He could be around the beginning of the period of the Shoftim. That's easy. It's 28 years of Yehoshua. But and that's the other one we have to mention, is Pinchas. Because Pinchas is going to play a role in the story of Pilegesh Begiva. In chapter 19, we are going to see Pinchas all over again. And that's the other point that Professor Eli Tzur makes, is it's awfully hard to put him at the end of the period of the Shoftim, and he's still running around leading the people and getting involved in things. Now, the truth of the matter is that we have a pasuk in Divrei Hayamim, which can be read to put Pinchas in the period of David HaMelech. But that depends on how you read that pasuk. The pasuk does not have to be saying that. Here, it's actually explicit. In Shoftim chapter 19, Pinchas gets involved in the war between the tribes. So, for those reasons, it's argued that, again, this event really belongs earlier in the story. And then the last point, Professor Yecheskel Kaufman makes this point, is that Dun, remember, Dun has two pieces of land. They have their land that they get initially, which is near the water, v'hulachof oniyot, like Moshe said, like Yaakov said, I should say, and they also have land up north, Yizanek min HaBashan. They also get this land up north that they take during the story of Pesel Micha. However, says Professor Kaufman, in Devorah's time, in Shoftim chapter 5, she lists Dun along with Asher, along with Gilad, and along with Asher. Well, that's already up north. So therefore, they're already up north in the days of Devorah. That must mean this happened in the beginning. I think you can argue that point, because Devorah also talks about them being with their boats, which is off to the west, neither here nor there. The point is, all of these people say it's got to be in the beginning. I gave you on the sheet, if you take a look at source number 4, I gave you just a one-line sort of footnote to all of the different factors that we just mentioned for putting this story at the end of the period. However, two leading commentators think that it's not true, that they occurred where it looks like in this point in the book, meaning at the end. Malbim says, look, it's the order they're written in the book, although he himself doesn't necessarily believe that, but he says, it's true, they're recorded at the end. But Radak says, it must be so, that it's actually at the end. Because the text is going to reiterate, as we said, Ein Melech B'Yisrael, there's no king in Israel. And Radak says, you go straight from Yehoshua and the Zakenim, the elders, into Asniel ben Kenaz. He says, it's got to be going on at the end. Has to be. And then you get Abarbanel, who's very entertaining. Abarbanel says, you know when this happened? It happened while Shimshon was being held by the Plishtim. Remember, we had the discussion last week about how long Shimshon was held in jail by the Plishtim and his hair growing and all of that. So Abarbanel thinks it was a long time. Everyone else thinks it grew fast. But Abarbanel believes that it was a long time that Shimshon was being held. And so what happened was, in chapter 16, we had the story of Shimshon. The Navi wasn't going to stop the story in the middle with Shimshon in jail and say, now let's talk about these other events that happen while he's in jail before going back to him bringing the house down on the Plishtim. Although that would have made a very good ending for Sefer Shoftim, when you think about it. Right? That would have been a neat ending for the book. Much better ending, frankly, than Pilegesh Begiva. But he says we instead conclude the story, and then we tell about what happened while Shimshon was in jail. Now, that actually fits with other stories in Tanakh. We have other stories that are like that. The stories we're going to be reading in the upcoming Parshios in the Torah, starting actually with the end of Noach, to tell you the truth. Whenever in Bereishis, somebody exits stage left, when someone is leaving the scene, we get the rest of their story. These were the many years that they lived, and this is when they were buried, or when they died, and when they were buried, and all that. And then we go on to stories that actually happened before they died that didn't involve them. Example, the end of Parshas Noach, who died? Who dies at the end of Parshas Noach? Oh, come on. You're already behind on doing the Parsha?
Terach.
Terach dies at the end of Parshas Noach. However, Terach is actually alive for a long time after that. Avram and Sarah are in Israel. Stuff's going on. Terach is still alive. Why did we put his death there? So Rashi gives you this famous story. It's in order that we not say that Avram abandoned his father. Throw me in the furnace and I'm not going to abandon you anyway. I don't know. That's why it does it. But it's a pattern. We do the same thing when Yishmael dies. When Yishmael disappears from the story, we record his death. Even though he's not dead for a while. We do this. We keep stories together even at the expense of chronology. So maybe with Shimshon. Shimshon's in jail. We keep his story all together, but these events happened while he was in jail. They're just recorded afterwards. Abarbanel has to say this. Because one of the big discussions we had when we started Sefer Shoftim was Abarbanel's theory about Shoftim. He believes that Shoftim are like kings, one after the other, with no interruption. There's always a Shofate. So he can't believe there's such a thing as a period when there is no Shofate. Then what? It's when Shimshon's in jail. That's when this happened. The Malbim, this is the last point that I'll make in terms of this argument, and then we'll get to why all this matters. But Malbim notes two midrashim that support the late dating. And I translated the Malbim here in source number 6, but I think I'm actually going to explain it outside of the text, because the first part is unclear if you just read it inside. The end of the story of Pilegesh Begiva, as I mentioned, has males of Binyamin kidnapping wives. There's a medrash that says that Shaul has a son, Yehonatan, from one of the women in that story. Shaul refused to kidnap her, and she ended up going to Shaul instead. And the medrash says that's how Yehonatan is born. Well, that means this story must have happened late. Yehonatan isn't 400 years old. So that's one point Malbim makes. And then the other one is the Yerushalmi says that this Levi in the story of the idol or the statue of Micha became responsible for storehouses in the time of Shlomo HaMelech, of King Solomon. So that again puts it as a later story, not an earlier story. So Malbim highlights Midrashim that support this. So there's more to be said about that, but I'm not going to go into it right now. The point is this. Majority view, this story didn't happen here. This story happened in the beginning. Some do bring proofs that it happened at the end. But let's ask the big question now. According to everybody else, okay, according to Seder Olam, according to Rashi, according to Ralbag, according to Malbim, these stories took place at a time other than where they are recorded in the book. Why move the stories? Why didn't you tell me these stories in the beginning?
Very shameful to put it, we're trying to push it off to the end.
Okay. It's shameful. Okay.
We're not proud of these.
So therefore we bury it at the end of the book and hope that people get bored beforehand.
Yeah.
Fair. not exactly what likely what I would say as a likely explanation, but
to the safer.
Sorry?
It's not a start to a safer.
It's not the best start to a safer, so we want to sort of move it in. Well, you could have, I mean, it would have been third parak by then. Besides, after this, everybody else looks great. Like, Avimelech is not half as horrifying once you've seen this. What, he killed 69 of his brothers? Yeah, fits into the times. So, a few ideas. One is geography. Where does Shimshon live? Correct. Bein Tzera'o, Bein Eshta'ol, the area of the tribes of Yehuda and Dun. Pesel Micha is going to involve Dun. That region is going to be involved. So therefore, we lead them one into the next. I think that's a relatively weak explanation, though. A second explanation emerges from the Gemara in Sanhedrin. Take a look, please, at source number 7. The Gemara here looks at the stories that we're reading here, the idol of Micha, the statue of Micha, and then this concubine in Giva. And he says, this is commenting, this is the last chapter of Sanhedrin. Remember that the first Mishnah in that chapter lists people who don't make it into Olam Haba. So the Gemara asks, Nipnei ma lo manu es Micha? Why isn't Micha on the list of those who don't make it into Olam Haba? Micha makes a statue, gets people involved in worshiping what seems to be something idolatrous. He doesn't belong in Olam Haba. Yeah, however, Mibnei Shepito Mitsuya La Ovrei Drachim. But he at least was hospitable. Right? The agents from Dun came through, and he gave them a place to stay. He took care of people. Hospitality is a nice thing. Bikshu Malachi Asharis Ledochfo. The Malachim, the angels, wanted to keep him out of Olam Haba. Amar Lan HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hashem said, Hanichu Lo, leave him be. Shepito Mitsuya La Ovrei Drachim. Because at least he's hospitable. He gives bread to passersby. Valdavar zenenshu anshe pilegesh begiva. And this is why they were punished in the second story, the story of the concubine at Giva, where no one was hospitable, or almost no one was hospitable, as we'll see. In other words, this story highlights a major moral downturn. I would add to this Gemara, it is highlighting a major moral downturn, that's true. But more than that, what's going to happen in the beginning of the book of Shmuel? What's the key thing happening in the beginning of Sefer Shmuel?
They want a king.
They want a king. And not only do they want a king, Hashem gives them a king. These stories are evidence that the Shofate model doesn't work. We saw over the course of this book a lot of different shoftim. We saw shoftim who were great spiritual leaders like Devorah. We saw shoftim who tried to set up their kids as shoftim after them and create a whole network, right? Like we saw with Yair. We saw shoftim who were kind of quiet and under the radar. We saw shoftim who were bloody fighters. None of them have been able to keep the Jews on the straight and narrow. And so this is essentially, to borrow a term from the lawyers present, Shoftim's closing argument for the need to try a stronger central authority. Because the central authority you've got here ain't cutting it. Shofate isn't working. Let's try Melech. That's a reason potentially for these stories to be here. It's to say, this stuff just isn't working. The Abarbanel is open-minded. Abarbanel, I said before, argues that these stories happened in the beginning of the Shoftim. But he's willing to make an argument in case it really happened at the end of the book. If you take a look in source number 8 on the sheet, he says, could be it's what I said half an hour ago. In terms of the structure of these stories versus the other stories. Take a look at what he says in number 8. He says, "Va'achar zichronam siper ha'inyanim ha'ele." After listing these other events from the other shoftim, it told these stories. V'mayosim kodmin bisman hayu achronim b'sefer. Even though they happened earlier, taking that view, they're still listed last. Lefisha nizkru yachad inyanim ha'shoftim u'mochamosehem, because they grouped together. Sorry, I jumped incorrectly. The stories that we just recorded listed the Shoftim and their wars. The Achre Ashlam Aslam, and then after that, Zachar Inyane Yisrael Shekaru Bimehem She'enem Misyachsim El Ha'oivim Vela Shoftim. Then we told the stories, which aren't involving any enemies, which aren't involving any Shoftim. In other words, I said to you before, there are no Shoftim in these last two stories, but the other thing that's missing is external enemies. Right? What's the line from Pogo? Right? We have met the enemy. What's the rest of the line? People of a certain age should know this.
And he is us.
And he is us, precisely. We have met the enemy and he is us. That's the story here. There are no Moabites and Midianites and Amaleki and Plishtim in the stories of Micha and in the stories of Pelegish Begiva. It's Jews fighting other Jews. So Abarbanel says if these stories are stuck at the end, it's because first we talk about Shoftim leading us against the enemies, and then we talk about the problems we had internally. Okay. So again, three reasons why these stories would be pushed to the end if they happened earlier. Either because they involve Dun, and that's where Shimshon is, so it leads from Shimshon's story. Or because they demonstrate the depth we sank to in this period, and it's a good closing argument to bring against the Shofate model. Or it's because these stories are after the stories about Jews dealing with external enemies. Now it's about Jews dealing with themselves. Yes, Chuck.
What I have difficulty with is that immediately after the death of Yoshua, the Sefer starts off by saying the Jews walked the proper path all the days of Yoshua and immediately thereafter.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that somewhat consistent with the theory that immediately after the death of Yoshua, because it has to be fell into such a depth of disgusting behavior, isn't it more likely after the last Shofate, who did not give a moral example necessarily, isn't that the more likely time it happened?
You can make the argument. I mean, I'm not one of those to pile on Shimshon, not least because that's a dangerous sport. But I hear what you're saying. It's hard to imagine that you go from Yehoshua to Pesel Micha. It's a fair statement. Other comments or questions regarding that? Okay.
Yeah.
I think so.
And so I don't know how the other explanations work if you don't explain why that line is there.
Well, I mean, the other way to read that line, just as Howie was a little bit low, your speaker was low, so I'll just reiterate or summarize it. Howie is asking the reiteration here, which you're going to see in chapter 17, sentence 6, chapter 19, sentence 1, chapter 21, sentence 25, is Ein Melech B'Yisrael. There is no king in Israel. So if you take the explanation for these stories being here as to highlight the need for a king, that line makes a lot of sense. But otherwise, what's that line doing there? So my answer would be the line is just there to say, all this stuff you're reading, this ridiculous behavior, is a function of not having strong leadership. having nothing to do with it being the closing argument for the book, but just a general statement of this is how you got this way.
But if this occurred at the beginning, it should say a Shofing, not a Mel.
Maybe.
Starting Shofting, and unless you're going with the explanation that Shofing and Mela is one and the same, that's what it should be saying.
Right. I mean, no one says they're one and the same. Abarbanel is closest to that. Abarbanel believes that they're sequential, but Abarbanel does not believe that Shofate is hereditary, for example. He doesn't equate it. It's a fair point. It's a fair point for sure. So these two stories, wherever they happen, whenever they happened and wherever they belong, are stories which are going to show us a Jewish people with a very warped nature of Judaism. You're going to see a house of idolatry used to worship God. That's what you're going to see. You're going to see people defending righteousness by dismembering a corpse. It's a bizarre story. It's Yishai Yashar Beinav, people just coming up with, hey, I think this is a good idea, and let's go do it, and other people following them. You're going to see corruption of an entire Shevet. First Dun, and then Binyamin. You're going to see the principle which Pirkei Avos calls Avera Goreres Avera. One transgression leads to another. Things just keep getting worse. Fundamentally, the phrase that comes to mind when you read this is just dumpster fire. It's a complete and total loss. And in the way that people deal with each other, as Sanhedrin noted, and in the way people deal with Hashem as well. The only difference is, once again, that the first story seems to have some humor to it. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 10, number 9 is just the lines where the text says, Ish hayashar beinav yaseh, everyone did what was good in their eyes. But take a look at Professor Kaufman's comment in source number 10. He's talking about the Micha story. Ha-mesaper mesapera sipuro b'ni'ima ironit. He says, the author tells the story in an ironic tone. Micha medaber koved elilim fetishisti. Micha speaks like he's some kind of idolatrous fetishist with no rationality to what he's doing. Meaning, the people of Dun are going to take away his statue, and he's going to say, Es Elohai Asher Asisi Lakachtem, you took my God. Which is a sentence that has no meaning. What do you mean, you took my God? If it's a God, people can't steal him. But he's not thinking rationally. Think like Terach and the idolaters of Avraham's day, as recorded in the Midrashim. The HaKohen Mitu'ar Ki Careerist, Kal Dat, if you ever wanted to know how to write careerist in Hebrew. HaKohen Mitu'ar Ki Careerist Kal Dat. The Kohen is described as a frivolous careerist. B'nei Dan him anshei agrof pru'im v'cham sanim, and the people of Dan are fist fighters, lawless, and thieving. That's what you're going to see in this story of Pesel Micha. Okay, so we've talked a lot about these stories. We spent 45 minutes talking about them. Let's start on the story of Pesel Micha. Take a look, please, at Perek Yud Zayin, chapter 17. We'll get the beginning in. Everyone has it? Okay. Vayhi ish mehar Ephraim. There was a man from Mount Ephraim. Ushmo Michayhu. And his name was Michayhu. So Har Ephraim, you may remember, is sort of where everything happens in Sefer Shoftim. It's a region, it's not a mountain. All sorts of stuff happens on Har Ephraim. And there's a man here from Har Ephraim. His name is written here as Michayhu. It will become Micha later, and we're going to talk about that change. Vayomer le'imo, and he says to his mother, Elef umeya hakesef asher lukach lach, the 1,100 silver coins that were taken from you, ve'at alit, and you took an Allah. What's an Allah? What is an Allah? Aleph Lamed Hey? A Shmua, an oath. You swore, v'gam amart be'oznai, and you even said it in my ears. that oath you declared in my ears about this money that was taken from you. Hinei hakesef iti, ani lekachtiv. Ha, it's with me. I got it. I took the money. Vatomer imo, and the mother says, Baruch b'ni Lashem. Blessed is my son to God. And you notice in the text, the word used for God is not Elohim, which can just mean a powerful being, maybe refer to an idol. It's not that. It's, blessed is my son to Hashem. You see that? Vayashav es elef umea kesef li'imo. So he gives his mother back the 1,100 silver coins. Vatomer imo. And the mother says, Hakdesh hikdashti es hakesef lashem miyadi livni lasos pesel umasecha. I have consecrated this money to Hashem, from my hand, to my son, to make a statue and a molten image. Ve'ata ashivenu lach, and now I give it back to you. Unclear what exactly that means. Meaning, who's giving what to whom, and what's the son's supposed to do with it. But what is clear is the mother just thanked God for the restoration of the money and said, I've consecrated this money to God to make a statue. Which I would have thought you're not supposed to do. Vayashav es hakesef le'imo. And now the son gives the money back to his mother. So apparently the son doesn't want the money. Vatikach imo masayim kesef, and the mother takes 200 silver. Vatitneyu latzoreif, and she gives it to a smith. Vayaseyu peselu masecha, and he made it into a statue and a molten image. Vayihi beveis michayu, and it was in the house of Micha. Statue and molten image. V'ha'ish Micha lo beis Elohim, or Elohim, I don't know. This fellow Micha had a house of God, capital G or small g. Vayas ephod utrafim, and he made an ephod, some kind of a tunic, potentially a priestly garment, as well as trafim. Oh, that's a loaded word for us. Where do trafim show up in Tanakh?
With Rachel.
Right, Rachel takes the trafim of Lavan. Where else? There's another one, at least, I mean, there are more, but... So we're going to have to talk about what these trafim are. With Lavan, they seem to have some kind of supernatural resonance from the fact that when Lavan says they were stolen, he says, Lama ganavta es Elohai. Why did you steal my gods or my powerful things? So he's got these, Micha, in his house. Vayimaleyes yadachan mibana vahilo lekohen. And he had one of his kids become the Kohen. The lady's not on the scene yet. So Micha says, I'm gonna outfit my house of God, not only with a statue and molten image, but also we should really have, I think, vestments, I think. And we should have trafim, whatever those are. And a Kohen. And this section concludes, by Imahim in Melech B'Yisrael, there's no king, Isha Yashar Beinav Yaseh, everyone does what is good in their eyes. Oh boy. We have to have a lot of questions about this story, you know, just what we've seen so far. What bothers you in this story besides the fact that there's some kind of weird idolatry going on? What else? Yeah. What is the game? You hold the money. No, you hold the money. What else is odd about the money?
It says it twice, that he gave her back.
Right, well, that's part of what Michael's pointing at, but what else is strange about the money?
The mother's reaction to the theft.
That's an interesting one. Right? What is her reaction to the theft? And what does it say about her?
Well, it depends if she's using, if Tanakh is using Lashon Saginor, what it says, Baruch B'nei Lashon.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. Is she blessing her son or cursing him?
Yes.
The thing is that it's hard to think that she's cursing him because then she gives him the money. But then the question is, how did she go from swearing at whoever took the money to blessing her son? This is a very mercurial person here, or so it seems.
Well, is it hard to keep doing that? She gave up.
Yeah. She gave up, so now she's giving him a bracha.
She's married to him.
Okay.
If this is true to the theory that this story took place at the beginning, there was still a remnant, possibly, of people being allowed to set up shop immediately after coming into Israel. So perhaps it wasn't so out of the ordinary for people, right? Because when they first came into Israel, until Shiloh was set up, they could set up their own place of worship on different hills or whatever. It didn't make a difference.
You could set up a Mizbeach for Hashem wherever you wanted at that stage. That's correct.
So maybe this was still part of that process where they were still setting up their own temples.
Right. Possible. Definitely possible.
Quantum of the money the same as what Zelila got?
Yeah, 1,100 silver coins. 1,100 is not a number that just flows off the tongue, you know. And yet we just saw it with Dalila. 1,100 coins was what the Sarnei Plishtim, the Plishti nobles, gave her for turning over Shimshon. Well, that's bizarre that would show up two stories in a row. 1,100. It's not like we ever see that number elsewhere. So that's a good question. Something else about the sum of money. One last question here.
You only used 200 of it.
Yeah! What happened to the other 900? You dedicated 1,100 to God, but when it came down to it, you gave him 200 to make the statue. Would you pocket the other 900? Like, what kind of shell game is going on here? The whole story is so weird. The whole story is very strange. And we need... Sorry?
Micha's name suddenly changes on A.
Right. Right. We need to look at the change in Micha's name. That's definitely going to be a piece of this. But I think one of the things that we need to work with here, and I think the starting point in this conversation, has to be the question of who is Micha at this stage? Is Micha just somebody who was idolatrous all along? Or does Micha evolve in the course of this story? And the truth of the matter is that you can bring views on either side. We'll see Rashi and Radak in one camp. We'll see Ralbag in a different camp. It's not so clear cut. And it's going to matter when we see him later on by himself a Levi. It's gonna have the same question of so who is this guy? What is his story and what is his agenda? If you take a look in source number 11, you'll see Radak, and I'll stop with this, but just to start us on that question of Micha's identity, Rashi and Radak both take this view. He says, "Va'amar Rabbi Seinu Zal, Kol Elohim Ha'amur b'Micha Chol." This is a Gemara in Shavuos Lamed Hey Amud Beis. Anytime you see the word Elohim in Micha, it's mundane. It doesn't mean God. It means powerful being. It can mean idol. Chutz min echad shu kadosh. Except when we get to the line that says at the end of the story that the idol stood, kol yimehayos beis Elohim b'shiloh, as long as the house of Elohim was in Shiloh, that one is Elohim for real. That one is God. But everything else that's going on in this story is idolatrous. So as far as Rashi and Radak are concerned, Micha goes into idolatry. However, as you'll see, it's his mother who's going to lead him there. His mother is the one who's going to lead him into idolatry. That's the way Rashi and Radak read Micha's story, while Ralbag is going to argue not necessarily. And that's, I think, what we're going to have to start with next time. Is the other perspective, but this is such a fun beginning to what is such a weird story. So I'm looking forward to a few weeks of weirdness before we descend into the horror that is Pilegesh Begiva. So Shkayach, thank you everyone, and tune in next week. All right.
Just check when Radak said that it's not the